Much of the island of Greenland is covered by a sheet of ice more than a mile thick. If all of Greenland's glaciers melted, it could raise global sea level by almost 25 feet. That's not happening anytime soon, but each year, the ice does go through a cycle. Each summer, some of the ice melts, and each winter, new ice is formed. For the past 3 decades, summer melting has consistently exceeded winter ice formation. And at one point this past July, satellites showed that a record 97% of the surface of Greenland's ice sheets were melting. Ben Linhof is one of a handful of scientists who were there witnessing this event from the ground. Ben's a third-year grad student in the Chemical Oceanography Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He spent the summer camping near the Leverett Glacier in Greenland and studying the processes of glacial melting and movement. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626 or emailing us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. We're also on Twitter at Living Lab Radio. Now, Ben, this was your second season, spending a few months camping right near a glacier. You're a third-year student. Did you come to Woods Hole knowing that you wanted to study glaciers, you wanted to spend your summers camping on a glacier in Greenland and doing this kind of science?
Actually, I came to Woods Hole planning on studying groundwater in Cape Cod and studying...
That's a bit of a switch.
Yeah. yeah, I was planning on looking at uranium isotope disequilibrium, which is this whole other topic. But my advisor got involved with this project out in Greenland and asked if I'd be interested. And I said, yes, of course, I'd love to go study glaciers in Greenland. That sounds really exciting and really interesting. So I jumped on the project and spent 2 field seasons out in Greenland.
Did you have any wilderness camping experience before this?
Yeah, quite a bit. I guess I was in the Boy Scouts growing up. I've done a lot of backpacking. I spent a year in Mongolia as a Fulbright fellow back in the day. And so, I've spent a lot of time in backwoods parts, but nothing like Greenland.
So where were you in Greenland this summer exactly? Can you describe where you were and how do you get to your field site?
Yeah, so we were in the on the western margin of the Greenland ice sheet. So if you look at Greenland, we're like halfway up the country on the western side. And our camp was located on a little peninsula of land, of tundra, that was sticking out into the Greenland ice sheet. So we were in this pretty small area that was... like surrounded by ice and then rivers. So we had ice and rivers kind of cutting us off from the rest of the world. So to get to camp, we were, we drive from this town of Kangerlussuaq, about 12 miles down this dirt road past a plane crash and some other stuff.
A plane crash?
Yeah. There's a, I don't know, it's Greenland. But anyway, it's an old fighter jet that went down a long time ago. But, anyway, it was never cleaned up, but that's another story. So we go past the plane crash. You take a right after that and go down the road. You come to a river, and then we have to cross the river. And in the early season, when we get there in May, the river's frozen, and we can just walk across. And then once that river starts melting, then we have a boat system, this little inflatable raft boat thing that we have a pulley system that we pull each other across and pull all our gear across. So most equipment is brought over on this boat.
So talk about the equipment that you do take. I mean, you're going for months at a time to do science. You've obviously got to take a fair bit of scientific equipment, but then you're going to be living there. So you've also got everything you're going to need to live, and you're driving and then packing and boating most of this in yourself to your field site, right?
Yeah. And I think we probably pack too much, or at least I did, because we're at this oceanographic institution, and I think that, you know, usually we're used to packing for cruises or going out into the ocean, and when you go into the ocean on a boat, you can take lots more stuff and you're not backpacking it all in. So we brought extras and extras and extras of everything. So I ended up with 800 pounds of scientific gear that had to be hiked or helicoptered in. So the gear we brought, lots of detectors and instruments and backup instruments and spare parts. And then, you know, I brought a couple tents and all my camping gear and a couple sleeping bags, a really, really cold weather sleeping bag for the early season and a warmer weather sleeping bag for later in the season and stuff like that.
We also brought, you wrote about your experiences the past 2 field seasons in a blog, and it was posted on the Scientific American website this summer. And in reading those, you said you brought some I guess we wouldn't necessarily think of them sitting around here as creature comforts, but some things to help make you a little bit more comfortable, including a table and a chair, a cot to sleep on so you weren't just laying on the ground all summer. And then the one that really amazed me was car batteries. You packed in car batteries, I guess, so you could have more electricity. What were you powering with the electricity?
So first of all, we had to hike in car batteries. And then first of all, when we cross the river, it's a 2-mile hike up to camp up this big hill covered in sand dunes. So it's not a nice hike, but with the car batteries, we charged them off of solar panels or a generator that we had in camp.
Which you also had to hike in?
We had two generators that we were able to helicopter in, and then one that we carried in, a small one. Generators are big.
Yes, indeed.
So I was powering my laptop and some of my instruments in my tent off of the car batteries.
So I know you also wrote about running and the fact that this was one of your, I guess, releases or ways of kind of burning off steam and getting away from camp a little bit. You took your running shoes with you and you would actually go running up toward the glacier? Did you ever run onto the glacier?
No, I never ran onto the glacier, but because it's really slippery. I ran on muskox trails. There's a lot of muskox around our camp, and so I'd run on these muskox trails over the tundra. And it was great. It was so beautiful. When you run on muskox trails, oftentimes you run into muskox, which was exciting because they are they don't run away like deer or something. You know, they usually stand you down and they can be kind of aggressive, but usually they run away. It's funny, when we first got there and you'd see the muskox, they'd run away from us, and then they kind of got hip to us and realized we weren't a threat, and then they wouldn't run away, and they'd expect us to run away. But anyway, that was sort of exciting.
So how many people were you there with?
My first season, there was more people. We probably averaged 6 or 7 in camp for the 3.5 months I was there. The first season, then second season, this year we were much fewer people, so it was probably around 4 or 5 people, depending on the month.
Talk about some of the personal relationships and some of the challenges. I mean, that's a long time to be in a very small area. You guys are working really hard. Did you know each other beforehand, or do you kind of get to know each other while you're going through this intense experience together?
So I didn't know anybody else going into this. It was we were partnered with the British groups from University of Bristol and University of Edinburgh, and so they mostly knew each other. But the group was fantastic. Like, there was no way, you know, I was definitely not the strongest or best member of the team. Like, everybody, you know, the team was really, really good, and you know, we didn't have a single fight or anything. It was just like people worked hard and worked together, and we kind of took care of each other.
I guess that's what you have to do when you're out there all by yourself. You don't have a lot of connection to the outside world, and you don't even have much of a safety net. You guys really have to be everything for each other.
Yeah, we really, you really have to watch out for each other. And, you know, like if somebody goes off to check on their instrument down by the river, you know, like, you know exactly where they are and you know when to expect them back. And if they're 20 minutes late or half an hour late, you know, you go out and try to find them, or, you know, make sure that they're all right, or if they need a hand or anything. So,
well, let's talk about safety for a minute. I mean, how much training do you get before you go on an expedition like this in terms of wilderness camping, wilderness medicine, and safety issues in general?
So I've taken some wilderness medicine courses before I came out here. I wasn't able to take a refresher course before I came out here, but the British team members did take a number of wilderness safety classes and crevasse rescue courses and things like this.
So you weren't actually camping on the ice, as you said earlier. You were on a little patch of tundra right next to the ice. How close were you to the edge of the glacier?
So I guess as the crow flies, a couple hundred meters. But to hike there, we had to hike up and over a hill, and then to get on the ice, it was probably a 20, 30-minute walk.
So how much of your research was actually on the glacier, and how much was on the ground next to the glacier?
So most of my research was, I was measuring meltwater chemistry coming out from underneath the glacier. So something like 99% of the water that comes out from a glacier comes out from the bottom of the glacier, from underneath it. And so I was measuring the chemistry of the water coming out from underneath.
So how do you do that? I mean, you just walk over and stick a bottle in the water? Is it as simple as that?
There's a lot of putting bottles in the water and taking samples at all times in the day and night. But we also have probes in the river. So we're not underneath the glacier. We're not sampling underneath the glacier, of course. We're sampling the river that comes out the front of the glacier. So yeah, we have lots of probes and instruments sticking in the water, and then we take tons of bottle samples that are currently sitting in a crate in Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
Now, you mentioned in your blog posts that as the melt season gets going, you can see really dramatic changes in the water level of that river. At one point this summer, it changed almost 20-fold in one day, you wrote.
Right.
And you've got all of this equipment that's there to sample the river. So how do you handle that? How do you make sure that equipment, which cost a lot of money and cost you a lot of pain to hike it in there, how do you make sure that it's safe?
So it's a pretty nerve-wracking early in the season before the river goes off. So early in the season, that the river will be this small stream coming out from the glacier, and it'll look really nice and easy. And then once the ice sheet really gets warm, once the sun really hits it, you'll have, like this year we had like one really warm day, and that melted a ton of ice and flushed through a lot of stored water underneath the ice sheet, and the river just exploded and went up in really high, really fast, and the river banks are collapsing and rapids are starting to form. The glacier starts calving. Last year we spent like a week moving equipment, and we're just exhausted. Like, you know, we're taking samples and moving equipment and trying to keep it away from the river. And then this year the river came up much faster, and I was actually in town when this happened on one of my few nights away, but there was three people in camp who just made this huge heroic effort to move all of our equipment out of the river, and they stayed up all night moving things up and up out of the water, and they had to like put new rock bolts into the cliff walls to attach equipment to. So every few hours they'd get up, drink some tea, walk down to the river, drill new holes, and move stuff up.
When you say you had a really warm day, how warm was it, or how cold was it still during the summer in Greenland?
So when we get there in early May or late April, it's, you know, it feels like winter, like, you know, it's like in the 20s or 30s. And then by late May, you're getting up into the 40s. And this summer was especially warm. Like when we had that warm day, I mean, it was in the 70s. Like it was warm, like t-shirt and shorts weather.
I mean, it was warm enough actually that you actually have a real problem with mosquitoes, which really surprised me to read.
Yeah, the mosquitoes are horrendous. And this year they were especially, especially bad. Well, last season was a much cooler season, and we only had like 4 or 5 weeks of really bad mosquitoes. And then actually the wind is so heavy there coming off of the ice sheet that we only had maybe 5 days total of really bad mosquitoes my first season. And then this year we had like something like 7 weeks of just horrendous mosquitoes and warm weather.
So which is worse, cold weather and wind, or warm weather and mosquitoes?
That's a big toss-up because of the, like, we're surrounded by sort of sand dunes and things that make high winds pretty bad. And you know, you're in a tent. So if you're camping in a tent in the middle of a hurricane, it's not that great.
I'm talking with graduate student Ben Linhof about life and science on the edge of a glacier in Greenland. You can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626, or you can email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. Okay, so there were lots of mosquitoes, and you already mentioned that you encounter muskox. There are also foxes that I guess you guys kind of befriended and would actually walk right through camp.
Yeah, lots of little Arctic foxes. Or actually, there was like an Arctic fox couple. So when you spend enough time out in the woods or in the wilderness, you know, you kind of become friends with the animals. Maybe you're going crazy or something. But anyway, we had this little fox couple, Foxy Prince and Foxy Princess, we called them. And they actually had pups this year, so that was cute.
What about polar bears?
So they're really rare in that part of Greenland. There was a polar bear shot in the nearby town in 2011 while we were out there. And that's actually a funny story because we were in camp and we're like 3 months in, and we've, you know, it's like warm weather, and we're thinking, no way, there's no polar bears. And we've sort of dismissed this. And then this helicopter pilot lands in camp and drops some people off. And he's this Danish guy. And he's like, yeah, there's a polar bear. May have been shot or maybe not. Nearby. Yeah, I forget. And then he leaves. And we're like, wait, what? Wait, what about a polar bear? Was it? Wait, what happened? And it turns out there was a polar bear in town and it got shot. And yeah.
There are also reindeer, caribou.
Yeah.
And you actually got a chance to taste caribou, I guess, while you were up there this summer.
Yeah, yeah, that was fantastic. The food in camp wasn't that good. Like, it was a lot of canned food and pretty bland. I mean, okay, it was all canned food. And a lot of it was pretty old. But we met a hunter in town in one of our few trips to town who sold us a caribou leg, and we hiked it into camp and butchered it, and it was amazing.
You also mentioned in your blog post that muskox burger is one of your favorite local delicacies. How sarcastic are you being when you say that?
I'm completely serious. It's really, really amazing. yeah, because you go into town and you have this muskox burger, and it's like, you know, they put bacon on it and lettuce and tomato and French fries. It's just amazing.
What about water? Are you actually drinking glacial meltwater while you're in camp?
So the meltwater coming out from the glacier is extremely full of sand and silt. So we drink water out of a pond next to our camp. So that's a change for people because, you know, you just walk down to the river or walk down to the pond and fill up your water bottle and you drink right out of it and just try not to mind the bugs because there's a lot of bugs in the water.
So this summer you mentioned you had this one really warm day, that it was generally a much warmer season. And in fact, the glacial melting in Greenland this summer made headlines around the world. Satellite observations showed that at one point 97% of the surface of Greenland's ice was melting. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that 97% of the ice in Greenland disappeared this summer. But that's still a really dramatic difference from most seasons. Could you tell what was going on just from where you were on the ground?
Right. So we didn't have, you know, access to internet. So we didn't know that this massive melt event was taking place. But what we did know was that the river was extremely, extremely big and violent, and large sections of bank that had, you know, very well-developed permafrost soils and, you know, were full of flowers and willows were getting washed away into the river. And there was also moraines, which are these big dirt piles pushed by the glacier. There were big moraines that had been there for probably hundreds of years that were also getting washed away. And so we were like, wow, okay. Not only is the river really big, but it's much bigger than normal. And so we did suspect something huge was going on.
I figure this is your second season that you are up there, so you've only got two seasons to compare personally, but I'm guessing you've looked at a lot of data going back years before that, before you went on this trip. Did you have a sense in terms of what you were actually measuring of how different from the historical average or historical trends this summer was?
Yeah, as far as meltwater discharge. So we measure the amount of water that's melting, which correlates to the amount of ice loss on the ice sheet. So I think we at one point estimated that over the whole field season last year, the ice sheet lost, or the glacier catchment area that we're measuring, lost about 1 cubic mile of ice. And this year, it seemed to be losing about that much every couple of weeks.
Wow, that is a lot of ice to lose in one season. Does this concern you? Is this something that you just measure and, you know, kind of objectively as a scientist and see, okay, well, this is the change that's taking place? Or when you see that, is there an emotional response that you have to seeing that kind of dramatic change?
Yeah. I think after being there, I'm much, much, much more concerned about climate change than I was before. And, I was concerned about it before, but now after seeing that, I think there's a lot more alarm bells going off in my head.
Do you get a chance to talk much with local residents when you're in town, perhaps at the beginning or the end of your trip, and what do they think of this research and what's going on?
Oh yeah, so that's kind of funny because I think when you're in Woods Hole and you say, oh, I study climate change, and people are like, oh, that's so great, but then in Greenland, you know, it's sort of a two-part story. You know, there's the traditional hunters and fishermen, and for them climate change is pretty bad, and it's changing their way of life, and you know, their way of making income is changing. And so for them, it's bad. If you're a mining company, then the climate change is great. Or if you're a sheep herder in southern Greenland, climate change is great. So,
I mean, I've heard also that fishing, at least cod fishing, is probably getting better in Greenland as cod are moving further and further north. And you did in one of your blog posts mention that cod fishing up there is nothing like cod fishing around here.
Yeah. It was so funny. So we went out into this fjord in this town of Sisimiut on the coast of Greenland, or I did with a couple of guys, and it was crazy. We put five lures on a line and dropped it down to about 100 feet, and then just started pulling up the line. And on every single lure, I swear to God, there was a cod like 20 to 40 inches just on our hook. And we just took them off and put them in a bucket and then put the line back down. And we did that for about a half an hour, filled up a bucket. And the guys were just like, oh, I'm so sorry. We just can't catch anything good. We're going to have to give this to the sled dogs because cod's just not the tastiest fish that we can get out here. And people don't really eat cod out here because it's not that good compared to, you know, Cape Cod, which is that's sort of our ideal fish, I guess.
So let's talk a little bit more about your research and what you've actually been finding. You go and you sample the meltwater, and you're in the chemical oceanography department, so you're actually looking at the chemistry of the meltwater. What does that chemistry tell you about what the glacier is doing?
Right. So the reason we're looking at the meltwater chemistry is to get a picture of the glacial hydrology, so how meltwater travels from the surface of the glacier to the base of the glacier and then out the front. And what people have hypothesized is that the glacial hydrology influences how glaciers accelerate. And so we think that there's a fraction of meltwater that travels from the top of the glacier down to the very bottom of the glacier, and then can pool up and get delayed there in that and slowly move out to the front. And that that pool of meltwater is responsible for physically lifting up the glacier and moving it forward in incremental steps. So there's actually a daily cycle of the glacier being lifted up and moved forward by this glacial hydrology, or by the glacial meltwater.
And so the glacier is almost floating on top of the water and gliding as it's moving during the summer.
Yeah, right. Because, you know, if you think about it, water is denser than ice. So there's the water at the base of the ice sheet can actually lift up the glacier and move it forward a little bit. And so we were looking at the trying to figure out the fraction of meltwater that is associated with that, and then see if we can use chemistry to predict when the glacier is accelerating.
So when you have a melt season like this year, where there was so much more melting than usual, does the glacier move more quickly as well?
So we're actually not sure. So in the early season, there's a lot more pressure underneath the ice sheet. So when water reaches the base, there's a lot more pressure and uplift, and the glacier can actually accelerate faster in the early season than it does when there's a lot more meltwater going on, or a lot more melt occurring. So this year, with unprecedented melt and a lot more water at the base, you know, it would be really interesting to look at that data and see if this caused the glaciers to accelerate more, or if not. And you know, maybe the glaciers will slow down after this crazy melt season, or maybe it'll speed up. You know, it's sort of an open-ended question, I guess.
So there's a lot we don't really know, I guess, about how just the process of how a glacier melts and how a glacier moves. How does that impact our understanding of what's going to happen with climate change?
Well, yeah. So there is a lot that we don't know, and probably a lot that I don't know. I think the glacial hydrology will be really important for understanding how they accelerate, and we're still trying to figure that out, I guess.
How do you respond to people say, well, we don't understand how this is happening. We don't even know that it's going to be a problem. Do we know enough to know that it's definitely going to be a problem?
Oh, yeah. So the ice sheet is losing a lot of mass, and it's losing a lot more mass than it's gaining. You know, you'll hear people say, well, the ice sheet is gaining mass in places, and that's true. So generally, in the center of the Greenland ice sheet, it's at its higher elevations, where the ice sheet is gaining mass as a whole. But around the edges, it's losing a lot more than it's gaining.
So we have just a couple minutes left, and I just wanted to touch on the culture shock of coming back to, I guess, what the rest of us would call the real world. You were out there for 3 months with just six other people, pretty much on your own and really immersed in this intense, intense research program up at all hours of the night. And then you come back and the world's pretty much on a 9-to-5 weekday schedule. And you actually had to come back and face your general qualifying exams, which are essentially like final exams on steroids that determine whether or not you get to actually continue your PhD studies. What was that transition like?
It was funny because I think, you know, I came back and I was like, oh my God, I need a vacation. And then it was like, no, okay, it's time to go to the library and study and study and study and study. But yeah, as far as culture shock, I think, you know, going to the grocery store is probably the toughest because, you know, you've been dying for an apple for months and then to see a whole stack of apples and you're just sort of overwhelming.
Well, we should say you did pass your general qualifying exam, so congratulations.
Thanks.
You're going to continue doing this research, I assume. Do you
Yep.
do you plan to be out in the season, out in the field next season as well?
Well, we're talking about maybe going to Alaska next summer, but that's still in the works. So we're talking about looking at a large alpine glacier in the Wrangell Elias National Park.
Do you think that glacier works differently than the Greenland glaciers?
So there's a lot of research that suggests that alpine glaciers move very similar to the Greenland ice sheet. And so that's sort of been an interesting finding, is that the Greenland ice sheet behaves a lot like alpine glaciers.
Obviously a lot to learn. I wish you the best of luck on your research going forward. Ben Linhof is a third-year graduate student in chemical oceanography at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Ben, thanks for being here this morning and sharing your story.
Thanks.
You can find a link to Ben's Scientific American blog posts on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.